Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. How is the Caramel Kid?
What? I'm good. What's Sean and Sean and White Devil saying?
He's keeping his eyelids open with matchsticks. He's so tired. His baby's got a cold and she's teething. So she gets up and, you know, like, she's either teething or she's on some kind of drugs because she's just chewing her face, going, blah, 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 at 2 o'clock in the morning, which is crazy. So I've not been sleeping much. I'm still trying to carry on running. I've been doubling, actually. I've been trying to do a run with her. Carry on.
Oh, boy, double days. So you, back to pro level?
Back to pro level with 3 to 4 hours sleep a night. It's going great. Yeah. But the first run, one of the runs is very easy because we're just I'm just jogging with her in the pram, and then the evening run is a little bit more spicy. But I started doing.
when you say spicy, go on.
Well, you know this thing last week. If you didn't listen to the episode last week, we talked about my DNA. So we had my genetic makeup analyzed by company DNA Fit, and they looked at what sort of training, based on my genes, I would be most receptive to. So what they said was, you are a 57% power receptive athlete and a 33% endurance receptive athlete. So I thought, right, I'm going to go back to my roots, and do some more power training. So
right.
I got out this week, did 15 times 200 with it's only like in a park, so they mark on. In Netherlands, in this park I run in, they got every 100 meter marked out. So I was doing 200 meters and then 200 meter jog. I was running between, my fastest was like low 30s, slowest was 31. So I was consistent, but I was really going. You know what I mean? I was dragging my ass around for 30. Yeah, my recovery.
I was flying. Yeah. My watch is 40.
Yeah. But I tell you what, it's better than. I was doing some 200s before when I was marathon training with a real short recovery. And I tell you what, I was doing like 33, 34, and I was absolutely gassed. So at least I was able to run a 30 second 200 with a, you know, minute and a half recovery in between each. I was pretty happy with how it went.
That's and a big tailwind.
There was a bit of a tailwind. It got me. As a runner, right, whenever there's a chance that you're gonna you've got a tailwind or a headwind, I'm always getting that tailwind behind me, always. You got to make the stats look nice, right?
Well, you know, yeah, definitely, because when you run, when the wind blows, it feels sometimes that it pushes you sideways.
Oh, it was good. I'm pleased I got it out and got it done. You been doing any jogging?
A little bit, obviously, just trying to build up slowly.
Yeah, okay.
It's hard work, though. It's hard work.
Yeah. We had a message from friend of the show, Dave Reagan, trying to get us for our next challenge. We talked about, like, having, after London Marathon, we had a competition to see who would, is a forfeit contest, won by yours truly, lost by the Caramel Kid. And we were looking, Dave Reagan suggests the race we should do it in fancy dresses, the Snowden vertical kilometre out in September. Which is a kilometer up here, isn't it? Something like, it's 5K run, but it's a kilometer.
It's 5K climbing. Run, but is it 10K or no? Sorry, 1,000. Yeah, 1,000 meters up
climbing. Yeah. And we had a look at it. We thought about it, and we're still thinking about it. We might have been confirmed with that one, but we'll have to see. But otherwise, we're going to try and get a 10K. Try and run us both in fancy dress.
Basically, Sean needs to ask the wife for going away coupons.
Exactly.
See if he's allowed to do.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe I can, maybe I can't, but hopefully we'll confirm that. We'll get Jermaine in a. Well, imagine doing a virtual, like, a kilometre uphill as a pantomime horse. I think that's not going to end well, surely.
No, that's injuries. We got to do it where we won't get injured.
Yeah, okay. Battersea Park for a nice flat 10K. Let's do that, I reckon. That sounds better. But hey, what have you been up to?
Obviously, working crazy. I went to sign in, and there's this new receptionist.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, you got to see the manager. I'm like, shh. You know, like when they're FNGs, we call them.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. And then I was like, okay. So I went to, I said, oh, I had my tea. Went to see him. And he's like, you've had a secret passenger come on your bus and assess, you know, like, he had a big list of assessments.
Ah.
I was like, all right. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And then he turns the screen around like it's going to be really bad.
Yeah.
And I see all these questions and then I see 83.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, oh, so it's out of 100, is it? He goes, yeah. So I was thinking, I've got nothing to worry about. I've scored 83. He goes, oh, well, you've come a little bit under company expectations. I was like, what? I was like, okay.
Yeah.
So he's going for it. He's going for it. He says, oh, your driving standards is good. All that's good, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes, the issue we got is customer service bit. I was like, okay. Okay, so the passenger comes on, I'm like, and then she goes, obviously, or he says, acknowledgement was 100%, so I acknowledged them.
Yeah.
They asked me a question.
Yeah.
And I answered the question.
Yeah.
So that day I got full marks for that. And then and it says, they also asked you where the bus goes. So I answered that and they said, obviously, knowledge is good, right? Yeah, so I was like, okay. I was thinking, well, where's the problem?
Yeah.
They said, oh, you wasn't friendly. And because it said it's like politeness 50%.
What?
So I wasn't rude, but I wasn't friendly. So imagine you're driving like 8 hours a day or every day, and people just ask the same question: does this bus go to Elephant and Castle? And obviously you just say yes, right?
Knowledge 100%.
It's like, I'm not going to go, oh, yeah, it goes Elephant Castle via the chicken shop. Yeah. And we could stop up there if you want, you know, pick something up. Right? But in my head, I want to say, well, of course we go to Elephant Castle because it says it on the front of the bus. That's what I want to say. So they say, oh, does it go to Elephant Castle? I just say, yes.
See, Jermaine on his bus. Don't be asking him no questions. Don't be asking him no questions.
So the manager was upset that I was. He says, "Oh, you're too cold." I was thinking, "No, they're asking for a question. I'm giving them the question." I say, "Not rude, not friendly, just mutual." I said, "There's nothing wrong with that." I said, "This meeting's over. I'm done." I said, "You can't get nothing on me." I said, "I'm going. You're wasting my time."
So from now on, you got to buck your ideas up, Jermaine. You got to be nicer on the bus.
They say, are we going here? I have to, you know, like do a little show for them. I don't think so. Yeah. I said, if they want spice and sugar, they should tune into Let's Get Running podcast. If they want that.
But anyway, this show, we should, before we start this interview, we should talk about news. Because we were going to start a new feature. There goes Achilles the dog in the background. The new feature called News. And on our news segment this week, we're going to talk about, well, there's a couple of things. In Britain, there is coming up on the bank holiday weekend, there is a big clash with Britain's number one 10,000 metre runner, Mo Farah, taking on Andy Butcher and the new coming man. Well, hardly the new coming man, he's been around for a long time, but Nick Goulab suddenly running amazing times. He won, I think he got the fastest road 5K or the seventh fastest 5K in 20 years, something like that. And it was and the only person that's gone faster than him is Farah. So they're going to face off against each other in the Vitality 10,000 metres on Bank Holiday Monday, which should be exciting.
Ooh, if you're that's going to be really good because I'm working that day. Yeah, and my route goes over Waterloo Bridge. Obviously, Waterloo Bridge has been closed. So they've done me a favour. I get to go and sit on my bus, stop before Waterloo Bridge for half an hour. They've done me a favour.
So if you hear a London bus beeping manically when you're running along, if you're running the 10,000 metres, that is Jermaine. He's waiting for you to finish. Get on with it so we can get this route started.
I'll be cheering Goulab. 100%.
Yeah, I'd like to see him. We interviewed him back on the New Year show, so the first show of 2019. Lovely bloke, really nice guy. We also interviewed Andy Butcher. He was back a few years ago, like when I used to do this on me Todd. But never Mo Farah. We've never managed to get an interview of him.
Numbers were low then. Numbers were low.
Yeah. Get back and have a listen. Also, we shouldn't fail to mention the women's race, which also looks pretty stacked in terms of top athletes. Steph Twell, she won it last year. She's doing it again. Lily Partridge, she's won it in 2016. She's doing it again. And interviewee, well, they've all been interviewees, actually. And Gemma Steele, who won in 2014, they're facing off against each other. And the other one I'm interested in watching is Charlotte Arter. She won the night of the 10Ks on the track last year, and she's going to be doing that. She's running there. We'd like to have a chat with Charlotte. She'd be good to get on. We haven't heard much from her. It'd be good to see how she's training in the lead-up to this year's race at Parliament Hill.
Because I know the Vitality, I did it a couple of years back when I got chicked for the first time.
Yeah.
They give really good prize money.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
So I entered last minute thinking, I'm going to run it. I think I should win it. I'll be all right. And I could buy myself a new PlayStation, you know, PS4. And then Scott Overall turns up. I'm like, ah! So at least this year, there's a good standard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's always quite a good standard. You had your head in the sand like some kind of ostrich. But it should be a good one. If you're up for watching it, it's not a fast course, I don't think, anyway. There's some sections that are quick, but it is quite windy.
There's all the turns are U-turns.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, it's slightly hilly.
Yeah,
it is. Not hilly, but like inclines, gradual inclines, because people think, London's flat. But when you're running it, it's actually incline.
Yeah.
Like when you're going up Blimmin Regent's Park and stuff, you're Regent Street, you think, bloody, I didn't know that this was slightly uphill.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not an easy course to run quick on, but those boys will run quick on there, that's for certain. But hey, that's the British 10K champions, I think. And on the day before, interesting, they got a mile as well, a road mile, with two big athletes in there. They've got, well, Shalane Austin-Clark is a pretty interesting competitor there. She's an indoor 800-meter championships European gold medalist. She's really like she's ice cold, isn't she, Shalane? She's a really good competitor. And then again, we've got, she's racing against Laura Muir, which should be an amazing race. So looking forward to seeing who goes well in that. And in the men's race, I think we've got a nice race with Chris O'Hare. He won the bronze medal at the 3,000 metres European indoors. And it'll be interesting to see how he gets on. Yeah, but cool. So lots of stuff going on. There's also been a team selected for the IAU Trail 50K Championships, including big names Alison Dixon. She's running it. She's up in her game from marathon to 50K. So she's been included. And Paul Martelletti for the men's.
Not related to you.
No relation, unfortunately, and we don't share any
DNA.
So I'm not very good, and she is. So yeah. So yeah, unfortunately, she got all the talent. We're not even related, but she got the talent, and I got none, unfortunately. But
you got stuff. You got the best shuffler.
I'm the best shuffler. The best.
The best butt dragger. Says me when you whoop me, but yeah, no, it doesn't matter.
So that's interesting. And then, actually, one thing we missed out a couple of weeks ago is the men's 50-mile world record went by is it Jim Walmsley, American fella, wearing these new Hoka One shoes. So I think they tried to do something similar to the Nike 2 Hour project.
Okay.
And they tried to run 100 miles in, or was it 100 miles? Or they tried to do a 62-mile race, 100K race, and set a world record. And one guy, Jim Walmsley, if I'm saying it rightly, he set a 50-mile world record in these new Carbon X shoes. I don't know if they're borrowing something similar off the Nike 4% shoe, but yeah, interesting.
Hoka set the race up, and then someone else won it in different shoes.
No. He won it. He won it in the Hoka shoes. Yeah, he's a Hoka athlete. Okay. But it's like a similar kind of marketing thing to Nike.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's kind of it for that. That's it for our news. We'll obviously, we want to find out a race for us, maybe try and get that virtual. Okay. I'm still trying to work out if I'm going to try and do some mountains this summer. So we'll try and hook up with that. But anyway, but we should talk about the interview. We've got a great interview with Colin Griffin. So Colin is a race walker. Well, he was a race walker up until 2014. So based over in Ireland, he went to two Olympics, 2008 and 2012. But it's pretty punishing on the body, I think, race walking. So Colin decided he's going to give marathoning a go. And he's not running to qualify for the Olympics, but he's very interested in running. He's always been interested in running. And he also is a strength and conditioning coach over in Dublin. And he's studying his PhD around Achilles and ankle injuries. So we're going to talk to him about that. But I guess from our perspective, Jermaine, he's very interested in biomechanics. Did you bother with biomechanics when you were like at the top of your game?
I think biomechanics is more important as you're getting into running.
Okay.
Because it's easier to learn.
Okay. But you must have been doing drills and stuff when you were competing.
For hurdles. Yeah.
Okay.
But obviously, if we're just talking about just running.
Yeah.
I know, like, say, like, an easy one is, you know, like people, you know, the iPhone arm, they call it, you know, when your one arm's sort of lower.
Yeah. Okay.
It's hard to do when you're doing a rep because you're only focusing on running as fast as you can.
Yeah.
But if your coach obviously knows about it, when you're coming towards them, they can obviously look at you as you're running towards them, and then they say, obviously, right arm up, right arm, right arm.
Yeah.
And so, but yeah, that's what my old coach used to like try and do.
Yeah. I think it's
definitely more effective when you're just learning it because it gets embedded more.
Yeah, I think you can make massive gains. I think, well, not massive gains, but I think you can make, for those who aren't necessarily gifted like me, I mean, you watch some guys like you, you're a gazelle, like, you can run. I can't run. And I think, actually, even at all levels, it can make a big difference thinking about biomechanics. Like, the way you hit the ground, you know what I mean? If you can improve the efficiency of that, that's huge. You can get huge gains from changing the way you land not even necessarily to land, but improving your interaction with the ground can make huge difference. And I think it's one thing that I was doing when I was running well. I was doing at least 2 sessions of drills a week with specially focused drills, with knowing what I wanted to get out of it. I stopped doing those because I just, you know, I've got old now, I've got time. And you can see my mechanics are pretty bad. Like when you watch, let's see, video photos and videos of me, I was talking the other day about...
It's all about video. So, like, for people to improve, they would need to get a buddy, video themselves, and like them, you know, like build it up that way.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. And there's a lot of companies out there doing these things where they do, they'll video you in it on a treadmill and stuff. And I don't mean necessarily like that. I think running on a treadmill is different to running outside. That's what, you know, you're running outside is what you do. So, yeah, you can do it. And I think we should all spend more time thinking about it. But it's finding a coach that can give you the advice to do that. And I guess following people like Colin who have an interest in biomechanics and actually come from a standpoint of being scientists and someone who actually has studied these kind of things, not just some jack of all trades who does it as a running coach. But hey.
Just a quick side note.
Yeah.
People have messaged me previously to this, and obviously I'm going to bring you up on it because you keep saying it.
What?
They say, why does Sean always say, I'm like, you're not talented? Because when you talk, you say, I'm not talented, I know, but obviously you're a good runner. So they're getting annoyed that you're saying you're not talented, but you are a good runner. Maybe a bit too hard on yourself.
Maybe. Well, I think it's like, I was never, right, so primary school, I was the big kid, right? I was the kid who was last in the sprint races, right? I was probably last in all the races in primary school. Secondary school, I wasn't very good at running. I only started running because my friend got in the running team and he didn't want to go on his own. So I had to go along so he had someone to hang out with on a Saturday morning. The only thing I'm good at is I'm receptive to training. Do you know what I mean? I guess I shouldn't. I've got a talent for that.
That in itself is a talent.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, I'll stop being so down on myself. That's just my natural way of doing things.
Because we got to be positively thinking podcast to make people feel motivated.
Yeah, but there's a difference between positively thinking and being, you know, like a fully yourself Jack the Lad, you know?
They don't want to listen to miserable old gits.
That's true.
Because I've already got the poor man's Usain Bolt title.
And I'm downbeat Dixon. Yeah. That's true. So I'm going to be certainly listening to what Colin's saying about, and I think personally this year I'm going to be trying to change some things about my interaction with the ground and trying to improve that efficiency. And I will try and talk about it on the show.
He's going to lay on it. He's going to kiss it. That's sort of interaction.
That's it, yeah. Give it a little cuddle every now and again, yeah. So, yeah, well, I will document, let you know on the show how that's going. So, yeah, here we go. Here's Colin. We will chat to him now. Colin Griffin. How are you doing, Colin?
Hey, Sean. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Great stuff. And you've just come off the back. We had a good marathon in Rotterdam this April.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I took almost 2 minutes off my PB. Happy with how it went. I just had to, you know, the last 10K or 12K were tough enough, but that's the way marathon goes, I suppose.
Yeah. And what was the time in the end?
2:26:43. So my previous best time was 2:28:20 from Dublin last year. I was in around 2:26 shape. I thought at very best, maybe, you know, 2:25 could have been on the cards, but I knew I was, you know, strong enough. You know, assuming things weren't too severe to hang on and do 2:26, and that's kind of how it turned out. I went through halfway in 73:07, and you know, even though my second half was a little bit slower, but it was just a question of holding it together, as opposed to as things can go in a marathon when things do fall apart, you can lose several minutes. So I was just happy enough to grind it out and minimise the losses, I suppose, the last few K.
Yeah, and what's next then? What's the next goal?
About to become a father in the next few days. So that's a big milestone. So it's very hard to plan too much along behind that, but look, we'll see how the summer goes. I'll get back racing over shorter distances in June and July, and then hopefully do Dublin again in October. I always like Dublin. Some athletes, you know, maybe the weather can be hit and miss. Some people like the course, some people don't. I think it's just nice to race in the city I live in, which your own people are supporting you and all the rest, you know, and the organisers really, you know, do a good job in looking after the athletes and that as well. So, no, I always enjoy racing Dublin. I've done it 3 times now, and definitely something I'd like to keep doing as long as I can.
Yeah, excellent. And you've got a very interesting background to your marathon career. So I mentioned at the beginning you're a 2-time Olympian, but that wasn't for, let's say, a traditional running event. You went as a race walker.
Yeah, I was a race walker for the best part of my career from, I suppose, I specialised at the age of 15 and qualified and competed in 2 Olympics in Beijing in 2008 and London in 2012. And then I retired from, I suppose, international competition in 2013. I guess at the age of 30, 31, I didn't want to be, you know, exercise has always been a part of my life and I didn't want to just do nothing. So I still wanted to keep fit without the technique and the stress of race walking. So I suppose I continued doing some running and some gym work as an S&C coach. That'd be part of my weekly routine anyway. And I started entering short races in 2014, did a 5K, ran about 16:40. And, you know, that felt hard. But, you know, I then started doing 10Ks. And then in 2015, I ran my first Dublin Marathon in 2:33. And again, my training, and I suppose your listeners are going to hate me for saying this, but my training would be fairly, you know, fairly modest. Yeah. I don't really aim for any weekly mileage target. At the time, I was maybe running 4 days a week, maybe doing 2 S&C sessions a week. Yeah. Like now, in the last year, I've been kind of maybe running more consistently around 6 days a week, maybe getting up to 60 miles a week, maybe in the last 2 months before a marathon. But I suppose my aerobic fitness and background as a race walker has probably stood to me in my marathon career, even though the biomechanics and technical demands are different. And that's probably where my biggest challenge is.
What was that like, the sort of going to those Olympics? Was it an incredible experience? What was it like turning up in Beijing as part of the Irish team?
Very contrasting experiences, I have to say. Beijing was, you know, it was different. Where, you know, it was different culture, different continent. You know, it was well organized and all that, but it was just London was just, it was like a home Olympics for us. It was special. You know, in our generation, I think we'll ever get the chance to have a game so close to us again. I know Paris is not too far away, but for Irish people, like, you know, so easy to travel across. There's so many Irish people in London. Just the build-up was special, and to be part of it was something I'm, I suppose, proud of and I suppose fortunate to have been had the opportunity to do that.
Yeah. And does it make you think, sort of with the Tokyo kind of just around the corner, do you think, could I give it one more crack and go back to race walking, or are your days completely done?
No. I've had my chance now, so I have to, I live with that now, so it's that. No, it's just, it'd be too much to take on in just over a year. And
why did you stop in the end? What was the reason you decided to stop in 2013?
I suppose I've had a roller coaster career as a race walker. You know, some of the highlights were finishing top 10 at World Youth, European Junior and European Senior Championships, and top 15 at World Cup events. But in some major championships, I've also been disqualified. And I suppose London Olympics, I was disqualified just before 40K. I was having the race of my life. I was on for a big PB, home games. I mean, it was almost like an experience, you know, that you would nearly dream of. And that was disappointing. And even though all through my career, I've always been quite resilient, handling setbacks, getting back onto it again, you know, taking a day or two just to reflect and, you know, get the motivation back. But the morning after my race in London Olympics was the first time I woke up, you know, asking myself questions. Do I really want to keep doing this? You know, kind of put myself out there again. And I suppose when I got back from the games, talking to family, friends, and people were saying to me, look, you know, it's hard to keep bouncing back from this. You know, you're 30 now. I was in a long-term relationship. And I suppose I sacrificed my working career for the best for all of my 20s. And, you know, it was also time to start looking at that as well. And after that stage, we came back from London, myself and my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, we planned to go traveling for a few months. She was based in Belfast. I was based in Limerick. So we spent a few months traveling in Australia. We spent the first 6 weeks doing the whole camper van stuff, East Coast. We spent Christmas and New Year's in Sydney, which is great. And then in January, then I spent a few weeks in the Australian Institute of Sport in Canberra. And I was always good friends with the Aussie athletes there. So I was actually training with them. And I suppose I got my that little bit of motivation back. And things were going well. And then in 2013, I was dropped from the high performance funding or to be fully funded for that year. And that made things difficult. So I just had to weigh things up. And I gave 2013 a decent go. And then at the end of that season, then I just had to decide. And look, I couldn't weigh up my options and I suppose put my career and I suppose family planning first.
Yeah, yeah. And looking at your training, were you doing a lot of similar things when you were training as a race walker to now looking for marathons? Is there similarities between the approaches in both sports?
Yeah. The principles are the same, you know. Endurance training is endurance training. The training plan for 50k walker is probably the same as a marathon, but as a race walker, I was training full time for most of my career, and I was able to, you know, train twice a day, do 100, 120 miles a week regularly, and you know, get my nap in the afternoon. Whereas now, like I'm working with a full time job, doing a PhD, and I do other private work, you know, mortgage to pay and things like that. So training has to, you know, is down the priority list. I try to focus on three key running sessions a week and make sure they get done whenever I can. I sometimes have to juggle days to do it. And then look, if I get in a 4 mile run or a 6 mile run or a 7 mile run on the days in between, or if I have to take the day off, so be it, you know. The consequences are less. But yeah, so I mean, the principles are the same. I suppose just my routine now is totally different because there's other priorities.
And like biomechanically, how difficult was it to make the transition from the walking to the running? There's got to be huge differences between the two.
There is a difference, but I suppose I had a running background as a youngster. But even as a race walker, I would have, in my early winter training, I would have done a little bit of running maybe in the month of October. And I was always able to come back from my few weeks off, you know, with a few extra kilos from my break and jump in with a few runners who was friendly with Limerick and be running along, you know, doing 6 minute mile pace. So that was always my baseline. So that made, I suppose, aerobically that fitness was there. Obviously, when I get down to under 5:30 or 5:20 mile pace, until this year, that was a challenge to be efficient there. Like, so, and that's still like a work in progress.
Yeah. How did you get to, like, because for me, I've always been into in endurance running because it's quite easy at school. You went and had there'd be your PE lesson, you do cross country in the winter and stuff. So you get an opportunity to run. How did you get into the sport? How did you get into race walking originally?
Yeah, so it goes back a long time. I suppose my family background, which I suppose gives a big context. My dad moved to my hometown, Ballinamore, in 1964, and he was a teacher. He got involved in athletics when he was in uni, and he formed the athletics club in my hometown. He was involved in coaching, and he was director of coaching for Athletics Ireland in the 60s and 70s, and was team coach at the Olympics in 1972 and 1980. So he would have drove the coaching side of things. Then my mother was an international runner, so she would have started off as a 400, 800 meter runner. And then towards the end of her career, she moved up to marathon and ran a 2:41. So she competed internationally, represented Ireland at World Cross Country, you know, it's quite competitive over 10K and 5K and up to marathon and towards the end of her career. So that's the environment I grew up in. So in terms of race walking, my dad would have coached a lot of events. He would have coached race walking in our club. He would have been a race walking judge. So like any youngster, like I suppose I tried a lot of things. And I always had a curiosity for technical events, even as a youngster watching events at track and field championships. And I liked hurdles. I liked long jumps. And I was always fascinated by the technical side of race walking and always wanted to try it. And yeah, so I was still running a lot as well and was quite competitive on the track, you know, at maybe 13, 14, 15, and would have placed quite well at national level in cross country. But I was always kind of fourth, fifth in my age group in race walking at under 13 and under 14. And then at age 15, I kind of specialized a little bit more, started winning medals and winning national titles, and then won a school international title, and things kind of took off from there.
Yeah, fantastic. And so you're still obviously have a keen interest in the technical side of things and in the sport as a whole, because your career now is a sports scientist.
Yeah.
But you're based in, is it the SSC? I've got the name of the place right. SSC Sportsmed Dublin.
The Sports Surgery Clinic in Dublin. We have a sports medicine department where I've been working since 2014, so pretty much the year after I retired.
Yeah.
And I suppose so I worked there as an SSC coach.
And is that predominantly through with runners or and race walkers, or just you across the whole gamut of sports?
A lot of sports, and even some like general population as well, which is good because you learn a lot from dealing with different, I suppose, backgrounds.
Yeah.
So I deal a lot with injury rehab, particularly foot and ankle, lower limb injuries, and running injuries, and then also have the research background as well. So
yeah, and you're studying for the PhD now.
Yeah, I'm doing a PhD looking at Achilles tendinopathy rehab. I'm looking at runners with Achilles tendinopathy and looking at a certain approach to rehab and see what sort of changes we can make in certain time frames and what sort of improvements we can see in strength, calf muscle strength and reactive strength and power, as well as changes in running biomechanics. So there's a few different strands to it. So I'm doing it through the sports surgery clinic, support my research, my PhD, and I'm linking in with Professor J.B. Morin in the University of Côte d'Azur in France. So it's a good partnership and it's a good team, and obviously I've got great support within the clinic, and I suppose it's an area I'm interested in as well, and JB is a great supervisor to work with as well.
Excellent. So do you I suppose you can't give away too much away until you've finished everything off, but what sort of findings are you coming up with the research?
Like most injuries, I suppose, you know, people kind of focus on the pain and they would progress according to pain, but sometimes what we see, what we see is that with most injuries there is a change in function, or there's a performance deficit there. So there's a lack of strength. There's maybe biomechanical asymmetries. There's maybe training load factors as well.
Yeah.
So sometimes if we can improve function and improve some of those performance qualities, change biomechanics, you know, that can often sort out the pain in most cases. So with our rehabilitation program, we're trying to see if an athlete can achieve a certain threshold of strength relative to the body weight, particularly calf strength and general body strength, and we have good reactive strength, so achieve a good jump height from a short contact time. So yeah, improve the efficiency of their Achilles tendon and calf muscle.
Yeah.
Does that... I suppose, take care of pain and allow them to get back to their sport and perform at the same level, if not better, than they were before injury.
Yeah, okay. So you're very much a keen believer in the importance of additional stuff for me, because I get out, I just run. That's just my thing.
Yeah,
I've got limited time, so I just go out and run. But you're a keen believer in the importance of, well, it sounds like for avoiding Achilles tendons problems and rehabbing from to do these extra things, maybe plyometrics, that sort of stuff, to get you...
Yeah, I think... It's probably an area that's most neglected traditionally in distance runners. And as you said, people like to get out and run. And I get that, because, you know, myself, I do both. And I like running. I like being outdoors and that. And, you know, there's a great, I suppose, endorphin release from that. But I do think a lot of athletes perhaps try to increase their running too much. They probably have some underlying weaknesses that have been neglected. And I suppose when it gets to a critical stage in the running, when things start to come to the surface, when they get injured and break down at the most untimely occasion, and you know, then having to strip things back and try to address these things. So, and obviously, as well, like in endurance running, you'll read a lot of commentary, and I suppose I see a lot in Ireland among some distance coaches who were good athletes in the 60s and 70s and 80s who never did S&C, and they think you know that they had argued there's too much emphasis in sports science now and not doing the basics right, which is true to a point, but back then they were probably so physically so well.
Yeah.
As physically conditioned, that they probably didn't need that much S&C work, whereas nowadays we're a lot more sedentary and perhaps we just can't handle the same training loads as athletes of the previous generation could.
Yeah.
So can you run your way through that, or do you try to do extra things to try to support yourself to train at that level and perform at that level or better?
Yeah. I remember talking to the Danny Gripper, Steve Jones is a guy, he's quite a physical job when he was sort of running quick marathon times. I remember Danny Griffiths obviously now is running 2:11, and I said, "Did you do any strength and conditioning?" He said, "No, but I'm working on the farm, and my S&C is catching sheep and diving after sheep. So I guess you're much more physically able to deal with that if you're outside all day on your feet."
Exactly. Yeah. First in an office, sitting at a desk for, you know, 8 or 9 hours a day, 5 days a week. Yeah.
Yeah, and then because for me it's difficult. I don't have much knowledge of S&C, so I'm not like I'm not able to really know what I should be attacking. How would like someone like me? I'm running a lot. I'm running 70 miles a week. How would I think about starting off and putting together a good S&C plan to improve my rank?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, how specific you go with it has to be on an individual basis. So you always look and assess the athlete, see what they're lacking most, if that can have an impact on performance. So, you know, you would do a battery of tests, but for a very, very basic, you know, program, I think if you have some sort of plyometric exercise in there,
Now
that doesn't mean you go straight into plyometrics. If you haven't had a background in that before, you may need to prepare the ground for that. But some sort of plyometric exercise in there that's of high intensity, some sort of a general, you know, whole body, multi-joint exercise, like a squat or a deadlift, and maybe the same for a single leg exercise, like a step up or a lunge. You know, if you've thought those three things in there, that's the basis of a good program. And, you know, it doesn't have to be too complicated. It doesn't have to be too time consuming. All you're trying to do is just keep the athlete running as consistently as possible and not do any harm. So no need to go out and fancy or crazy. Just keep the stimulus in there, because you don't want the program to get boring, you know, and get monotonous. So they do the same thing week in, week out, you know.
Yeah.
You do try to chase numbers, try to see performance changes, and make sure the exercise that you're doing is actually achieving something or changing something. Otherwise, that he may as well be sitting at home in front of the couch.
Yeah, putting an extra series on Netflix,
No, I was just saying, I suppose, most relevant to my research. I mean, you know, I suppose we're starting to appreciate now how important the calf and the Achilles is for distance running performance in particular, because, like anything else, things tend to go through different sort of paradigms. You know, it was all about the core years ago, then it was the glutes, and now, you know, the calf muscles are probably, you know, if you take a distance runner versus a sprinter, the level of calf muscle activation is not that much different. The only difference is the sprinter uses their hip muscles a lot more to have a faster and more vigorous swing phase, and then attack the ground, put more force into it. So the calf muscle is always working close to its full capacity. There's a lot of stress, shortness, cycle loads going to the Achilles tendon, and you know, I do think that some focus on calf strength for an endurance runner is important.
Yeah, because actually one interesting thing in my previous training cycle for Frankfurt, I started doing a Canova style training regime. So I was doing a lot more, not any long slow runs. It was quite focused marathon training. And I had a lot of trouble with my calf. And the guy that was advising me at the time, he said that's quite common, just because your calves aren't ready for that kind of long, intense kind of running. And I hadn't thought about doing any sort of calf raises and that sort of thing. And I'm really now, from that point, it's been really important for me to do that sort of thing to try and...
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, even you asked me there how different the technique of running versus race walking is. The one thing I'm finding in my marathon runs, especially towards the end of a race, the first thing that kind of gives me a little reminder are my calf muscles, because I'm not used to working that way, you know. So that just shows that they do take that there is a high demand on them.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, you've got a keen interest in biomechanics. Like, do you think it's something we can all make gains at? Should there be an onus on most distance runners to think actively about how they move and how they train? Do you think we can all make gains from doing that?
Yeah, no, it is a challenge, because, you know, we get efficient. We're probably lazy by nature. That's just human nature. We want the most efficient way to do things. We take up running or whatever it may be. We find a certain movement pattern and we get used to that. We get efficient at that. And I suppose a running economy can be based upon that. So if you try to make a change, there could be a short-term cost, you know. So I suppose you ask the question, what do you need to change? And, you know, how do you go about doing it? That's safe. That's not going to disrupt things too much. And in my work as an S&C coach and sports scientist, I spend a lot of time working in running mechanics and particularly with the injured population we deal with, trying to make some changes there where we see obvious biomechanical stresses that you could associate with the injuries. But for performance purposes, I'm a lot more conservative. You know, I think it's an area like S&C that's not really well researched for distance runners, and it's not something that distance running coaches traditionally put a lot of focus on, whereas sprinters do, jumpers do, you know. So why should distance running be any different? And I think how you interact with the ground is important.
Yeah.
And, you know, I see it more as maybe constantly fine-tuning rather than trying to make a wholesale change at once, because that can be risky.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to ask about being a coach as well. So how has your kind of career being very interested in the science and doing the PhD, has your coaching career changed as a result of things you've learned over the past few years? Do you have a different approach now because of the findings you've had as a scientist?
Yeah, I suppose you start off on a PhD journey thinking you know a lot about something, and then you realise you actually know very little. Throughout my own competitive career as a race walker and my early coaching career, I suppose my lens was very narrow. My influences were based on the people I would have worked with and I suppose resources I would have read and that. And I suppose the more now I get on the PhD route, the more other questions open up and the more I kind of think, God, you know, there's a lot more we could explore here. So I do have a bigger appreciation on the individual variances in how you might approach something. So different athletes have different needs, different capabilities, different capacity to handle certain training types.
Yeah.
And I suppose I do try to be as individualized as possible doing that. That can be difficult, but I suppose that's one thing I try to do. Being flexible, I suppose, as an athlete, I was self-coached a lot through my career. I probably didn't hear things I needed to hear often enough. Yeah. So having that objective every so often is important as well.
Yeah.
And I suppose just being flexible with your training, there's a lot more out there now on training loads and that and readiness to train and do certain sessions. And you know, if you have a bad night's sleep or don't feel 100% in a given day and you still have a session planned, yeah, 10 years ago, I would have gone ahead and done that session and dealt with the consequences. Whereas now, you know, especially when I'm advising an athlete, I would say, look, just get another night's sleep, have next day recovery, and you're in a better state to absorb or to adapt to that training stimulus in that given day.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think, how would you kind of describe your approach then to coaching like marathon runners? Have you got like a, you know, obviously you have a high mileage coaches and you have different kind of approaches to, there's 100 ways to skin a cat. What would you say is your kind of approach to doing that?
Well, I think in general, you know, all endurance athletes, I think you do need a period of a couple of years of, you know, deliberate aerobic endurance development. Increasing your training volume. But there comes a point then where you kind of, I think, max that out.
Yeah.
And you're into kind of law of diminishing returns territory. So, you know, are you going to get more benefit from going from 120 miles a week to 130 miles a week? Or are you going to get more benefit from improving the quality of some of your interval and tempo runs or maybe some of your S&C or plyometric training? So, yeah, so I think definitely a period at some stage in your 20s, ideally, but again, being careful how you progress the athlete through that, mindful of their capacity to handle that and maybe their vulnerability to injuries in that. And then in terms of marathon training, you know, you mentioned Canova's methods and principles, and I'd be kind of in a similar school as well, but I do think that you need to have a good foundation of your polarized training approach, your good volume of work at your sort of below threshold, your aerobic endurance, and then, you know, a small amount of work then at your, you know, upper end, your zone, your above threshold, or, you know, your higher intensity work.
Yeah.
And then I suppose as you get close to the marathon, then you're kind of doing that in between work, then your zone two, between your lactate threshold, lactate turn point, and that's kind of close to, well, my marathon intensity anyway, and I'm sure the same for others.
Yeah.
And increasing the volume of that. But I think there's a danger of maybe doing too much in that zone, you know, so it's just getting it right, getting the timing right, and knowing when enough is enough, and then when to pull back, you know, as the race approaches.
Absolutely. And is there sort of something you have working with various sort of athletes and runners, is there something you have noticed a trend that amateur trainers don't do something, or they don't address something in their training? Do you think that, like, a little change, you can't generalize about a whole group of athletes, but do you feel like there's anything that we could spend more time thinking about that would produce greater gains?
Well, I suppose I've mentioned the S&C work. Again, depending on what the athlete needs or what they're lacking, you know, I think biomechanics, you know, has a role to play too. Again, you just got to be careful going about it.
Yeah.
And then I think in terms of periodizing your year, I mean, I know it's difficult for distance runners, and I see it in Ireland, and I suppose the same in the UK, particularly those who train full time, and as they're living, you know, they have to race whenever they have a chance to race, and they might have a chance to have proper downtime and periodize the year and have that one big target. So, and that's difficult. I think if you're trying to get to a next level, you know, you kind of need to really kind of take those few weeks, you know, to just recharge the batteries and then have a proper build up rather than having to race regularly just to pay the bills. So that's a challenge. I don't have an answer to that, but that's, I suppose, a difficult one.
Yeah.
And then I suppose how you increase your training loads. And I think it's a big challenge in endurance athletes as well. And when I say training loads, a high training load could be a normal training session on a tired body. It could be a higher training load on that given day. So just being monitoring that and being mindful of that and making necessary adjustments.
Yeah. And one thing I'm quite interested in is mobility, because obviously back 5-10 years ago, there was a, you know, every runner should be stretching after they're running, and you know, now things change. And I don't really know what the current thinking is on the importance of flexibility. I don't know if they're different words, potentially, flexibility and mobility.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think we should be thinking about that? Because, like, I don't think a lot about it, and I think I have some lower back issues and potentially some hamstring issues, but because I'm not flexible. But is that a problem? Do you think mobility should be something that runners should also kind of be thinking a little bit about when they're in their routine, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's as high in the priority list as maybe some people would face it. I mean, yes, you need a certain level of mobility, but in running, you know, it's straight line. You're not in a position, so you need to be very mobile.
Yeah.
Your joints don't flex that much.
Yeah.
You know, so once you have nothing there that's going to stop you from moving efficiently, the benefits of trying to get more mobile or more flexible, you know, may not be worth it compared to other things. And I think the challenge, and I see a lot with female runners in my work as well, particularly you know, we're very, very mobile, lack strength and stability, they're more injury prone. So and they think they feel tight and all that, and I think they need to do more stretching, more foam rolling, more needling, more whatever else, but just need to get stronger and be able to move better and be more stable through their joints and handle that extra bit of mobility they have to enable them to run.
Yeah, makes sense.
And look, I mean, I'm not like in my own career, I would have spent a lot of time stretching, a lot of time working those things and got very little in return.
Yeah.
And since I started running, since I finished race walking, I do very little stretching and I'm nowhere soft.
Yeah. So basically, if you're concerned about, as a runner, you're concerned about stretching, you're better off spending your time doing a strength feed routine than you are doing a stretching one.
Yeah, I mean, It depends. It's just how flexible do you need to be, and I don't think you need to be that flexible. You need enough, and again, it's how much is enough for each athlete, and that's obviously there's some individual variances there.
Yeah.
But if you constantly have a tight spot and you constantly have to stretch it and constantly have to form roll if you get needled, well, you have to ask yourself, you know, am I actually putting out a fire here, you know, or am I actually dealing with the root cause of this? And, you know, then do you go back and see why is a certain muscle doing extra work? Why is there a weakness somewhere else in the chain? Am I moving in a certain way that's causing the area to be overloaded?
Yeah.
And, you know, is there a better, more effective way of making a long-term change here rather than just making these short-term little interventions?
Yeah.
And having to keep going back and doing this week in, week out and so on.
Yeah. I don't know where I read it. There's something to do with, there was two things. There's one guy who's, it might have been a German guy, but he said, everything you do as a runner improves your ability to do that act. So, you know, you lose weight, you get a stronger, more powerful heart, you get a bigger set of lungs, and also you become stiffer in certain places. And so therefore, stiffness is, I appreciate that stiffness is a different concept to tightness. But another one was genetically, East Africans and Kenyans, I think in this study particularly, are more likely to have stiffer Achilles tendons than Caucasian runners, but obviously that there's a different thing between tightness and stiffness.
So stiffness is a biomechanical term. It's more related to how the resistance of a body to applied force. So we talk about whole body or vertical stiffness being how much your center mass oscillates when you're in contact with the ground, so how it handles ground reaction forces. And then you look at joint stiffness, like knee or ankle and hip, and how much the joint changes or flexes in its different planes. Obviously the hip and ankle move in different planes in response to ground reaction forces. And then you look at the Achilles tendon and how elastic it is. So obviously when you hit the ground, the first phase of your stance phase, you're absorbing forces, or you're dissipating forces. The calf muscle is contracting, the tendon stretches, and obviously you want to have some sort of resistance to that stretch. So it's a bit like your elastic band, and that stiffness, I'm not saying the stiff, it's not a question of the more stiffer the better. There's an optimal range, I think, but you need some elasticity to allow the muscles to contract more efficiently. So the muscles in distance runners tend to operate more isometrically, and then most of the eccentric or most of the lengthening is done by taking up by the tendon. Sprinters then would have an even greater level of tendon stiffness, I suppose, enables like what you call like a catapult effect from the ground and more amplified power return from the ground. Yeah. Whereas distance runners are looking for that efficiency, so, and that's been linked to having superior running economy. So morphologically, that's what these African athletes tend to have. They tend to have long, slender lower limbs, a long tendon with a shorter calf muscle, and they're just able to store more energy in the tendon and use it more efficiently when they I suppose ping off the ground and have superior running economy.
Yeah. And is there any way, this is a, well, I'm probably going too far, but is there any way we can train that as potentially people who don't have the same mechanics? Can we train the stiffness of our Achilles tendon to improve that?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the one area that people, endurance runners, aren't really exploiting enough. Those who don't have some focus in S&C, because through heavy calf strength training and plyometric training, you can actually improve the efficiency of the muscle tendon unit, so the Achilles tendon and the gastrocnemius and soleus muscle, improve how they contract and interact.
Yeah.
But also improve the stiffness properties of the Achilles tendon. And I've seen in rehab, like, you know, you can make changes within 4 weeks by doing a very, very heavy calf strength training program, heavy isometrics. And I'm talking heavy, I mean, being able to lift calf raise more than your own body weight, maybe twice body weight, and you can make those changes in 4 weeks. You know, so definitely, you know, every biological system is adaptable in some way. Obviously, how much depends on the athlete and depends on their baseline. But if it's something an athlete hasn't exploited before, you know, there's a bigger scope there to try and make good adaptations and I suppose bridge the performance gap to some degree. I'm not saying you're going to match these African athletes, you know, just by doing this, but
yeah.
Maybe you get the point where the level field is a little bit more more and more level, I suppose.
Yeah, excellent.
The playing field is a little bit more level, I should have said.
So, moving on, what's your next focus for the next few years? Have you got other research you're looking into? You've got plans for the next couple of years? Oh, I suppose having a child's going to make everything different, but what's your intentions over the next couple of years?
Well, I'm hoping now, I'm kind of halfway through my PhD cycle. I'm hoping to get some of my work published, but we're only about to start our Achilles study. So we're hoping to recruit 60 athletes over the next year and give them our intervention and have another group doing a controlled program. So that's going to be a big one. But I suppose doing the PhD, obviously, I have the interest in lower limb mechanics in calf and Achilles, I suppose, function from a performance and rehab point of view. But there's other skills from a PhD I'm trying to get as well. You know, and I suppose the main thing, going back to performance and my background, I want to make a contribution, you know, and be able to provide something that's of value to athletes and coaches and practitioners. And so the big thing, there's a big mismatch there between the academic world and the, I suppose, the coaching world. You know, they both tend to work in isolation, and I suppose academics don't do a good job of disseminating their research findings in I suppose, user-friendly language for coaches and athletes. And I suppose, in a certain degree, coaches and athletes maybe don't want to hear about people who've never actually spent time on a track or on a training camp, or who've seen the different challenges that coaches face in day by day. So there's definitely a mismatch there that I think I'd like to, within my own capabilities, try to contribute towards. But it's something that can be done better. And I suppose just have skills that I can use no matter what I do in my, I suppose, in my future working career. I suppose I still want to be working in elite sport, but I suppose it gives me a broad set of skills, how I kind of analyze data, how I present data, how I suppose critically evaluate a situation, and how I communicate things as well. So there's a lot there that I want to try and get out of my PhD and hopefully add value to whatever I work in the future.
Yeah, and if any listeners are interested in, because I found you from Twitter from following the various articles you retweet or you post. What's your Twitter handle? Is it called a handle? I think it is.
Yeah, I got in there early at Colin Griffin. So my name.
Perfect. Yeah. So it's always a good option to follow, to pick up the latest articles and stuff. I'd highly recommend you do that. And then we've got three quick fire questions to go through, which is we ask all the interviewees in the show. And the first one is, if you could be anywhere running now, where would it be?
Ooh, at home in lovely Leitrim. On a weather like this, where I come from, it's just nice scenery, some nice little training routes around mountains and lakes. I don't get home that much, but when I do go home, I just love to get out in the countryside and just get away from things, have a little bit of headspace and just enjoy what's going on around me.
Lovely. Nice. Second question is recommend us something. So it could be anything, from something physical, like a book, film or TV show, or anything you want to recommend.
Ooh, I suppose I can't be a total sports nerd. So I don't really watch as much TV shows as I'd like. But recently I've been following Line of Duty.
I
think it's been on BBC. So I definitely recommend that.
Yeah. I basically, when Series 5 started, I hadn't seen it before. So I've started back on Series 1 and I'm now caught up to Series 5.
That's what I did as well, yeah.
Yeah. Are you nearly through it all?
Sorry?
Are you nearly through it all now? Have you finished, or have you still got Series 5?
Yeah, no, I'm up to date now because it just finished there last Sunday. So. So,
okay,
yeah, so
don't reveal. I'm on Series 5, Episode 3, so I've still got a couple.
Okay,
to
say
go.
No more. Yeah. Hang in there, it's worth it.
Good. And what is your, in your opinion, is the greatest endurance performance of all time?
Whew. I guess I'm going to be shamelessly biased here. And the men's 50k walk world record set by Johan Denese at the European Championships in 2014. I was there, even though I wasn't competing, I'd retired, but I watched that performance. He did 3:32 for 50k, which...
Whoa.
Most track and field people wouldn't appreciate that unless you put it into marathon context. So it was like a 2:58 or 2:59 marathon.
That's incredible.
So And look, he's an athlete I've got to know over the years. Someone I kind of believe in, because I suppose I've been in an event that's been blighted with doping, like most other track and field events, particularly Russian athletes who would have dominated our events and set world records in their backyard and that were never really scrutinised by the anti-doping authorities and all the rest. So. You know, I've always believed in Johan, or I've had no reason not to believe in it. And I was there to watch the performance. It was incredible. And so
fantastic.
That would be my,
Great. Well, thanks a lot for chatting, Colin. It's been good to catch up, and hopefully we'll get some people following you and checking out some new articles. And hopefully maybe I'll come over and race. Is it Ballymore 10K?
You're right. Ballymore 10K, Friday the 16th of August. You're more than welcome.
Yeah, excellent. Nice one. Thanks a lot, Colin.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me on.
I think Sean just likes clapping his hands.
So this is the third take, but yeah, nice interview there, Colin. Thanks for being on the show. If you are interested in catching up with any articles about the current thinking on various running topics, then I recommend following Colin on Twitter. He's always quick to retweet interesting articles and pieces of research that relate to runners and coaches. So do that and have a check it out. So, hey, what are you up to, Jermaine? You got any plans over the weekend and for the next couple of weeks?
No, football has been cancelled, abandoned.
Why has it been? So it's nothing to do with that guy that slapped his mate, is it?
No, all the officials, they just abandoned the league.
Really?
So the league folded. So we're looking for a new league to join, but we obviously can't join them until next season.
Okay. Well, send us your if you know about leagues, everybody, send us your leagues.
What I was going to say, remember a couple of episodes I told you someone stole my number plate on my moped.
Oh, yeah.
So obviously I was looking DVLA, looking for a new number plate, like a private plate.
Yeah.
And I saw MAY and then 51Y. So it reads Maisie.
Oh, yeah.
So I was thinking, oh, yeah, I want that. But obviously the DVLA do live auctions. Yeah. So they started yesterday.
Okay.
So I'm keeping, I'm obviously driving the bus. Obviously at each end, I'm looking at my phone to look at the live auction. I'm like, okay. And they've got plates selling, obviously at 9/11 C2 or something like that, sold for 25 grand.
Whoa, 25
grand? So I was like, so these plates are selling for big money. I was like, crap. So then like, there's like random plates that don't say anything in like words, you know, when you actually look at it.
Yeah.
But they were still going for like 5 or 6 grand. I was like, oh man, I don't think I'm going to get it, you know, that cheap, because my budget was £1,000.
Yeah, okay.
So I was like, okay. And then obviously the plate I wanted was getting bidded to, you know, going up for auction today. So I was thinking, okay, I'm going to put a bid in. Okay. So I had to keep an eye on the lots, because obviously it doesn't tell you when your lot's coming up.
Yeah, okay.
So mine's just coming up. It's three number plates away. So I was thinking, okay, I better practice, because I don't really know, you know, like how it works properly. So I said, so I'm reading the instructions. It says, oh, press the red button, obviously, to place your bid. Yeah. So I press the red button, and I'm like, okay, it says, okay, the bid is with you. I'm like, okay. Then I look across, it's 15 grand.
Oh, no.
I was like, yeah. My heart was beating so fast.
What was it for?
I was like, no way. It was like MAT, some numbers. So it was Matt something.
Oh, no.
I was like, crap. And then obviously someone else bidded, and I was like, whoo. But then it says, oh, the bid is against you. Do you want to rebid? I was like, put my phone down. I was like, no way. And then obviously my one came up, and I was thinking, oh, let's see, what's this flash like, 7 grand? And then it was like, no one bidded. I was like, okay, I'm going to put a bid in. But before I put my bid in, someone went to 700. I was like, okay, let me bid 50. It wouldn't let me bid 50 because it said someone is currently trying to bid 1,000.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So I was like, okay. And then it got to 950 and it stopped. So I tried to bid another 50 again. It says same thing, someone trying to bid 1,000. I'm thinking, what could they got? Dial-up. Bloody hell, what's taking so long? And then it goes 1,100, selling once, selling twice. I was like, 50, and he wouldn't let me put £50 in. And so I had to put 100, and then obviously I got it for 1,200.
So you are now Maisie.
I'm now Maisie. Finally, I've got a plate, and I didn't get robbed.
But Maisie's a bit of a, like, it's not very macho, mate.
Well, Maisie is my surname.
I know, I'm just joking.
But yeah, Maisie, obviously, people don't call their kids that anymore, so I'm lucky.
So if you see Maisie driving around on his little Vespa, whatever it is, a moped, keep an eye out for him.
I'm going to have 4 at the top, 2 at the bottom, so I'm just going to have MAY5 at the top.
Yeah.
And then IY at the bottom.
Perfect. Look out for it, people. Look out for it. Well, enjoy your weekend, Jermaine. Have a good one.
All right. Cool. What about you? What are you doing?
Yeah, me, I'm going to try. This is why I'm all over the place today. I'm going to try and sleep. I'm going to try and do a bit of running. And that is all I'm going to do. Actually, we've got, there's quite a lot, obviously, get Lido's in the UK. We've got our outdoor heated pool around the corner. So I'm going to be taking the baby there on Sunday for a nice little swim. So that's all I'm going to be doing. Chilling, running, sleeping. That is all I've got involved, which is going to be nice. So, hey. Should be good.
Sounds good.
Nice one.
Sounds good.
Right, we'll catch you up next week.
Cool.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.